Hi, everyone. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. My name is Emma Katz, and I want to thank Rabbi Ilan Siegelman from PUA in America for joining us tonight. Now, when I met with Rabbi Siegelman about planning this event, I was completely blown away. So I'm very excited to allow everyone to hear from him this evening. So Rabbi Siegelman is the rabbinic advisor for PUA in America, and he is going to share with us some of the top questions and issues that they deal with daily at PUA. So Rabbi Siegelman, again, thank you so much for joining us this evening. If anyone has questions, you can private message them to me in the chat on the side. Only I will see them, and we'll have time at the end for questions.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mrs. Katz, and thank you to all for joining us this evening. It's a real pleasure to be here in Chicago without having to leave my house. It's really fantastic. And I really thank you all for the opportunity to speak a little bit about PUA, to speak a little bit about what we do here in PUA and how we try to help the Jewish people. That's what we're all about. So I'm going to share my screen, and I'm going to share the slides with you tonight. And I'll give a basic background of what we do here at PUA. And as Mrs. Katz said, we will then have questions. And it's really, you'll just see a few of the questions that we get on a daily basis. And I think that there's plenty to discuss here. Okay. Can you all see my, can you see my screen? Can you see the, yeah? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And the last question is, can you see when I move my, with my arrow on the screen, can you see that or no?
Yes.
Okay. Amazing. Okay, so let me just begin with a basic background of PUA services. Here in America, we offer a number of different services for the Jewish community. On the top left box, you see guided to support. And we have different types of ways that we can help guide and support the community, whether it's medical guidance, which is referrals, or even in terms of the treatment itself, some guidance on that when in the realm of fertility, mainly. Halachic guidance, many questions that we get from all different areas of halacha. And as we go through tonight's talk, you'll see a little bit about what type of halachic questions we get. And certainly when it comes to infertility, whether it comes to Taharas HaMishpacha, these types of areas, genetics and intimacy, there's a lot of emotional support which is necessary. In Baruch Hashem, we have what we call the PUA Cares team, a group of professional therapists and social workers that specialize in infertility that are on staff that help anyone who calls, as well as financial assistance for those very costly treatments. Halachic supervision on the bottom. We have a West Coast and an East Coast office to take care of supervision in the lab, to make sure there are no mix-ups when people are doing fertility treatments, and we can get to that a little bit. And then, move the speakers out of the way, okay. And then on the right-hand side, we have education, all different types of education, conferences, lectures, rabbinic training. We train rabbanim all throughout the country, chassan and kala teacher training courses for chassan rebbes and kala teachers. We even have training sessions that we do, that we give for the doctors, to teach them about some of the religious sensitivities, what it's like to deal with a couple that is Orthodox, that is Shomer Torah Mitzvos, and not as easy as their other patients may be. And when a doctor has an appreciation and the sensitivity how to treat his Orthodox patients, it makes it a much more comfortable experience, not only for the patient, but for the doctor as well, when they're all on the same team. And we have college initiatives and high school initiatives. Baruch Hashem, we're able to find many different places to speak, such as Zoom this evening with the Neely organization. Now, when we deal with infertility, what is the medical definition of infertility? What does it mean to be infertile? What does it mean when someone is struggling with infertility? So according to the ASRM, which is the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, infertility is the inability to achieve a pregnancy and live birth within a 12-month window of unprotected intercourse. So that means that a couple who is struggling to conceive, they can't even get pregnant. That could be a couple that can get pregnant, but they suffer from recurrent miscarriages. Time after time, if there is a miscarriage and the woman is unable to have a live birth, that also is considered to be infertility. And the window of time is about 12 months. And it's very common that people call, whether it's their rabbi, their kallah teacher, whoever it may be, even before the 12-month window is up. And for the most part, it's important to know that the caller should know and be reassured that just because they don't get pregnant within the first year, even though it's 8 months, 9 months, statistically, that's not called infertility. Statistically, that's not something to worry about. They should be reassured that everything is fine, and they should keep on trying and try to not get too bothered or stressed out by the fact that they haven't achieved the pregnancy. Once the 12 months has come, so then we can begin the discussion. And this is really a serious issue, as it affects approximately 1 out of 7 couples, which means when you look around shul and when you look around the grocery store, when you look around the park, and when you look around wherever you are, there are so many people that are struggling with infertility. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they have no children. Sometimes infertility can mean they were unable to achieve a pregnancy for their first child, which we call primary infertility. And sometimes people are successful in having that first child, but they're struggling to have their second, sometimes even their third child. And that's what we call secondary infertility, when a couple is trying and they're unable to. And, you know, it's interesting. Sometimes, and I've heard this from many couples, secondary infertility could be even more emotionally challenging than primary infertility. Because when you're dealing with primary infertility, you know, you understand, listen, there's something called infertility. I must be infertile. There must be some issue. We have to take care of it. That's a really hard pill to swallow. But when you've had a child already and you know, or you think you know, that you're not infertile, you don't have to worry about this thing called infertility, and yet you try to have a child and you're unsuccessful and you don't understand why, because you look at your son, your daughter at home, you look at the children at home and you say, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm not infertile. I have children. I have a child. And yet you're unable to achieve that pregnancy. Sometimes emotionally, that's even more difficult for the couple than primary infertility. Now, as we said, that this tonight's talk is really called Just Another Day at Pua, or A Day at Pua. This is really the way of introduction, show you and bring you into the world of Pua to really present to you what a typical day at Pua looks like. And really, I kid you not, the questions that you're about to see, some are really basic, some are just remarkable, but they're all common and daily questions that we receive at Pua. So some of the questions that we'll speak about the question, or I'll present the question. Then we'll go into a few topics after the questions, although it may, you know, depending on the time, we may just be able to go over the questions. But I do want to share with you the questions, and then we'll have a slight, you know, we'll have a small discussion about something else, and then I'll be more than happy to go back to those questions if anyone has any issues or wants to discuss something. They could feel free to text it to Mrs. Katz to chat it. Okay, so number one, move this to the side. We are both 25, married for just over a year and not pregnant. So this is a very common question, right? Because the couple, not too old, right? 25, it's just the right age. And they're married over just a year, so they're not pregnant. So obviously a couple at this point, they don't know really what to do. They don't know where to turn. They don't know which doctor they should go to. They don't know if they should be going to a doctor. Are they doing it right? Are they not doing it? Is there something that they're not doing correct? So, you know, these are the kind of the first step questions. And it takes, you know, we have to go through many different questions to ask the couple to see, to kind of get the full picture, to see how we can best guide them. Sometimes they come, the questioners come with a piece of information which is helpful to guide them on their path. For instance, my wife was told she has PCOS. Are we infertile? So PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, is an extremely, extremely common occurrence, and especially in Ashkenazi Jewish women. PCOS, and we'll talk about this in a few slides. PCOS is when the body produces so many eggs. A woman produces so many eggs that the way the doctors explain it is like there's a traffic jam in the ovary. When you have a lot of cars on the highway, so then everyone goes slow because there's so many cars, it's hard to drive quickly when there's so many cars on the road. So when in the ovaries, when there's really supposed to be one egg, but instead of one egg, there are multiple eggs, like what happens in women who have PCOS. So since there are multiple eggs, there's this mini traffic jam that takes place in the ovary, and very often they don't ovulate. Without ovulation, it's almost impossible to get pregnant. So questions of PCOS are extremely common. Another extremely common question: I have a short cycle, and I think I'm ovulating before mikvah. So when a woman has to count her shivanikim, she has to count her days of her clean days before she gets to the mikvah. So that whole system of taras mishpacha exists, right, in conjunction with her fertility, the fact that she had a period, and right after the period, and she goes to the mikvah, so ovulation will occur somewhere around mikvah, and we'll discuss that after the questions are over. I have a whole slide about that. It's an extremely common question. So that is a serious issue. Many women are not getting pregnant because they are ovulating before the mikvah, and our goal is to try to make sure they ovulate after mikvah, that they're able to go to the mikvah to be together with their husbands in time for ovulation to allow for them to get pregnant naturally. Sometimes the issue is the male. And the doctor said, my husband needs a semen analysis. So the semen analysis is where it's important to take the zera, to take the sperm, the semen of the husband, to analyze it, to evaluate, to see whether or not there is sperm or healthy sperm in the zera that they'll be able to achieve a pregnancy. In order to procure that sample, in order to have the sperm available, it requires it to be extracted from the body. And as we know, halacha is not so fond of wasting seed, of shechva zera levatala, and therefore it's our job to figure out what is the most preferred method according to halacha for this couple to produce a semen sample for the semen analysis. This is a perfect example that we spoke about before when it comes to religious sensitivities, where a doctor will easily say, okay, bring in a semen analysis, come in tomorrow we need a semen analysis, we need a semen sample. You know, not so fast. That's a huge issue for us. The couple needs time to get over the fact that they're about to do this, which they may not be comfortable with. They need to reach out to Pua, they need to reach out to their Rav to see what the best way to do it. It takes time, and doctors shouldn't pressure their Orthodox patients when it comes to a semen analysis, because it really is something which does present tremendous pressure on the couple. We need an IUI. An IUI stands for an intrauterine insemination. An intrauterine insemination is a treatment where for whatever reason, the woman's not getting pregnant. The doctors feel like an IUI is in place. An IUI is where they take the zera and they inseminate, they deliver it to inside of the woman's body, they deliver it into the uterus, and they put it right on top of the uterus, right on top of the fallopian tubes. We'll see the picture in the coming slides. Sometimes when husbands have a low, the motility, basically the sperm, they're not such good swimmers. So since they're not such good swimmers, when the husband is motzi zera, when they have relations and the husband ejaculates and the sperm has to swim all the way up through the vaginal canal, into the uterus, all the way to the top of the fallopian tubes and into the fallopian tubes, sometimes the sperm, they just don't have the capability to do that. So the doctor gives them a little bit of help, and they put the sperm in this catheter, and they insert it all the way into the uterus, and they deliver it to the top of the fallopian tubes, exactly where the sperm needs to be to enter the fallopian tubes in order to fertilize the egg. So that procedure is called an IUI. Are there any halachic issues with this procedure? Is it permissible to do an IUI? My IUI is scheduled before mikvah. Is that allowed? Very often when women are going through this treatment for the IUI, so they would always, l'chatchila, initially try to schedule it that the IUI will take place after they have gone to the mikvah. But very often what happens is the women respond very well to the medication that they take in preparation for the actual insemination. And they responded so well that they actually had to move the date up. The doctors had to move the date up. They thought they were going to be able to do the IUI on Thursday. Really, they now want to do the IUI on Tuesday. The issue is the woman is scheduled to go to the mikvah Tuesday night. So they have to do the IUI on Tuesday before the woman goes to mikvah. Hopefully she will conceive, because that's the whole point of the game. But the issue is a woman allowed to conceive? Is a woman allowed to conceive and get pregnant from her husband when she was not tahora, when she was actually in nida at that time? True, she'll go to the mikvah that night, but at the moment of conception, it's very possible that she was actually in nida. Is that permissible? And what about IVF? Perhaps we've learned about IVF, in vitro fertilization, in which the eggs are taken from the woman and the sperm is taken from the man and fertilized together in the lab. And once the fertilized egg and sperm, which we now call an embryo, once the embryo is fully developed, it is then inserted back into the uterus and the woman hopefully gets pregnant that way. So is that permissible? Getting pregnant in a fashion which is so foreign to normal intimacy, to what the Torah had mentioned when we talk about a woman getting pregnant, pru ruvu and whatnot. So is that something, is IVF something that halacha endorses? And what about taking one's injections on Shabbos? People call about Shabbos questions. What happens if my retrieval is on Shabbos? So of course, this is a loaded question, and there's so many fascinating tshuvos when it comes to IVF. You should know that when IVF first came out in 1978, right, with Louise Brown, when the first baby was born. So if you look at the halachic literature in 1978, so many of the rabbanim, many of the gedolim of the time, Rav Yoshev, the Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Avadi Yosef, many of the rabbanim were extremely hesitant to permit IVF for a myriad of reasons. They were concerned about the sperm getting mixed up with someone else's egg. They were concerned that maybe the child born from IVF wouldn't actually be the child of the parents, right? When a husband and a wife have a child, so it's their child. But who's to say that if the sperm was taken and the eggs were taken and fertilized and put back into the body in a way which was so, you know, as I said, far into normal conception, so who's to say that the child actually halachically belongs to the parents? If the father, for instance, was a Kohen, right? If a father is a Kohen and he has a child through IVF, who's to say that that child is also a Kohen? And years ago, this was extremely, extremely controversial. As you may know, Baruch Hashem, 40 years later, the position on IVF has changed drastically. Many of the poskim of yesteryear have come around to actually permit it, and not just permit it. There was on one occasion, there was a fascinating set of tshuvos written by Rav Sternbach, who's an extremely Haredi rabbi in Eretz Yisrael. Rav Sternbach, one of the leading rabbanim, but extremely Haredi. Rav Sternbach initially, when it came out years ago, he wrote that these treatments are problematic and a person should not do them. And over the years, if you analyze the tshuvos from, you know, year after year that he writes about IVF, the pendulum switches, it swings and shifts towards maybe it's not so bad to maybe it's even okay. And his most recent tshuva is that it's actually a mitzvah. It's actually a mitzvah to go ahead and do IVF. And he explains what changed from all those years and all those tshuvas that he wrote, which were against IVF. What changed is how common these procedures are, how common, how normal things are. And when it's not that halacha changed, but the reality changed. And since these treatments are so accessible and available and commonplace, so therefore our whole attitude should be that, yeah, this is part of normalcy. This is part of normal life, getting pregnant. And therefore it's part of what he calls regular and expected hishtadlus, that a couple can and should, if they're able to, go ahead with IVF in order to have children. So those are a few of the questions that we get on a very daily basis about IVF, IUI, certain fertility questions. What about nida questions? So many classic nida questions that we get. I can't get a clean hefsek tahara. A woman is trying to do her bedikos. She's trying to do her checks before she goes to the mikvah, but she can't get a clean hefsek, but she doesn't know why she's menstruating. This is not a straightforward case. It's not a typical case. Usually, when the bleeding stops, the bleeding stops. And then their bedikos should be fairly simple. Mid-cycle bleeding and bleeding after after she has finished her period is usually not so common. And yet there are a number of women that are able to get a hefsek tahara. and she knows, or she can't get a hepsic tyra, but she knows she's not menstruating. She's just, you know, random bleeding, random spotting. She's not actually nothing maybe coming on her pad or on the toilet paper, but when she does a bedika, there's always something there. How do you advise such a woman? Or a lady who says that she always spots after she comes home from the mikvah. How many times do we get this question? With spotting right after the mikvah. Why is it happening? Right? So here in the question, should I change my birth control? That's already a good, that they have a good, little bit of an insight as to why it's happening. Perhaps it's the birth control, which is setting things off. And if it's the birth control, maybe it's kedai, it's worthwhile to consider changing birth controls. Sometimes even the same, if it's the pill, sometimes going from one pack to the next, or one type of different brand, even if it's the exact same medication, the exact shape, the exact same the exact same dosage, but sometimes it's just a different brand will do the trick. But we get these questions all the time. Is the IUD better than the pill? The Mirena versus the Paragard, the IUD, the intrauterine device, has become extremely popular in recent years. Many women are opting for the IUD as their form of birth control. And people have the classic question, should they go for the hormonal birth control? Should they go for the non-hormonal birth control? What are the pros? What are the cons of both? Let's go back to the fertility. Let's go back for the fertility questions. I'm 35 and not married. Should I freeze my eggs? Recently, fertility preservation, I mean recently in the past 10 years, fertility, and even the last 5 years, even fertility preservation has become extremely popular. One of the reasons why fertility preservation has become extremely popular is because it was actually deemed to be a mainstream treatment. For many years, it was still experimental as far as the American Society of Reproductive Medicine was concerned. Not too long ago, maybe in the past 5-10 years, they began to consider egg freezing mainstream protocol, and therefore there was a tremendous push for women to freeze their eggs, that a woman who is getting older and unfortunately still not married, she doesn't want to reach the point where she gets married at age 43, and then by the time she wants to have a family with her husband, she gets the news from the doctor that her eggs are simply not viable. We wouldn't want that to happen. Unfortunately, I've had this conversation too many times with women that have told me, why didn't anyone tell me about this? Why didn't anyone tell me about egg freezing and the opportunity to have fertility preservation? We wouldn't want anyone to go through such a traumatic experience. So we really, it's important to get the word out that women who are not married, who are of age, 35 is, you know, the question of how old exactly should a woman start freezing her eggs is an excellent question. I think by 35, 36 is definitely a good age. You don't want to do it too young, because you know sometimes it's inappropriate to do something so young, but you don't want to wait till it's too late, because as a woman gets older, as we know, her fertility does decline. You know, it's unfortunate to discuss it, but the you know, that biological clock, it really is true that as a woman hits 40, and certainly 41, 42, and all the more so 44, the studies show that there is a rapid decline as a woman gets older. So that's relevant for single women who are considering egg freezing, as well as women who are getting older and they're, you know, considering having more children. Then they have to realize that just because it was easy getting pregnant at 35 doesn't mean it's going to be that simple getting pregnant at 40. How can I be sure that my eggs won't be tampered with? This is a very common question that we get from women who are freezing eggs. And it's also a question that we get from women who are doing IVF, that their eggs are being taken from the body and brought into the lab. People are very concerned what happens behind closed doors. And that's why really, that's how PUA began 30 years ago. PUA began as a service to the Jewish community to supervise and to observe that all of the eggs and the sperm, all the genetic material being taken from the body and being stored and worked on and processed in the lab, that everything would be done under Jewish eyes, under supervision, to make sure that no one would, that there would be no mistakes, chas v'shalom. What about this one? I'm 45, no success with IVF. So a married couple, she's 45 years old. Unfortunately, she's done a number of IVF cycles, but she has not successfully gotten pregnant. And the doctor mentioned egg donation. I don't think the week goes by that we don't discuss egg donation with couples. And for whatever the reason is, whether it's the couples that got married later in life, or it's those couples that have not been successful in IVF, what are we supposed to do when it comes to egg donation? What is the halachic view on egg donation? And if you use an egg donor, so who will be the baby's mother, right? When you have an egg from a donor woman, and the Jewish woman herself is going to be the one carrying the egg. It's going to be fertilized with her husband's sperm. It's just that the egg is going to be from a donor, and she'll carry the baby and give birth to the baby. But who is going to be considered the mother? Is it the donor, the woman who contributed the genetic material? Or is it going to be the woman who carries the baby, the gestational carrier, the one who carries the baby and gives birth? Is she going to be the mother? With many, very, many, many halachic ramifications for this question. If the donor, for instance, is not Jewish, so and the woman who we're dealing with is Jewish, so who's the mother? Is this and we know that motherhood will is important in determining whether the baby is Jewish. So is the baby Jewish or not? Must the woman seek out a Jewish egg, you know, from a donor, a Jewish donor, to ensure that her child was Jewish, will be Jewish? Do we require a gerus, a conversion, if a woman has a baby through an egg donation, and the egg donor is not Jewish, right? So many of these questions. This sounds like a crazy one, but I can't tell you how many times I've had this conversation with women. I have no uterus. What are my fertility options? So very often, there's a genetic disease called Mayer-Rakitansky syndrome, in which a woman is born without a uterus. She looks completely normal. She looks like a totally normal female on the outside, just looking at her. No facial features are different. Her body features are, as far as anyone can tell, are totally, totally the same as any other person. It's just internally she lacks a uterus, just it never developed. What are her fertility options? What about this one? My husband was diagnosed with azoospermia, which means that the husband has no sperm. So the only way we can have a child is using donor sperm, taking the sperm from another man and impregnating the wife. I want a child of my own, but my husband can't think of me having a child from another man, and he would prefer to adopt. Who is right? And these are questions that we always sit with the couple and we discuss all these issues, but it's so important to know how common male fertility is and what the various options are for male infertility. We are both carriers of a genetic mutation. We'll go over to the world of genetics for a moment. The doctors offered us to conceive and then have an amniocentesis. So when a couple are carriers of a genetic disease, and I would say that every few weeks we get this question, the same question, and then throughout the week, variations of the same question. But I got a question very recently, last week, of a young couple, a boy and a girl, who were about to get engaged, and sure enough, they did Dor Yesharim, and the results came back that both he and she are carriers of Tay-Sachs. So they're about to get engaged. They want to do it. They want to go ahead with it. However, they are genetically incompatible. Should they get pregnant, should they get married and pregnant, so there's a 25% chance that every single pregnancy will be a Tay-Sachs pregnancy. 25% chance of every pregnancy. So what do we tell such a couple? Do we tell them to go ahead with it? Do we tell them to get married and then consider what the options are? Do we say that, wow, this is a siman from Hashem? This is, you can't get more clear that maybe this is not such a good shidduch. Maybe this is not exactly what Hashem had in mind. And every situation is different. And I can tell you that many, many, many couples break it off, and many couples go ahead with it. Now, just because they go ahead with it, just because they get married, knowing that she and he are both carriers of Tay-Sachs, it doesn't mean that they're going to have Tay-Sachs children. I venture to say that no one here actually knows a baby that died of Tay-Sachs, maybe a few people. But I would say the overwhelming majority of people on this call and on this presentation have never met anyone that died of Tay-Sachs, because very often it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen, Baruch Hashem. With Dor Yesharim, with all the genetic testing that we do, Tzedek's babies, Baruch Hashem, for the most part, are not born. So what does a couple that both he and she are carrying the same genetic mutation of Tzedek's, so what are they supposed to do? So the doctor offers them the following options. The doctor says you can do what's called an amniocentesis, which means you get pregnant naturally. And at about, let's say, 13 weeks, 10 to 13, 12, 13 weeks, let's say they do a CBS or an amnio. For those people that are familiar with the different tests that people do, the prenatal testing. And those tests are able to pick up on the genetic, the chromosomal makeup of the fetus. And they're able to tell us whether or not the baby has the genetic mutation. So you could do that. You could get pregnant naturally, have the amnio, but then what happens when the doctor says, unfortunately, this baby has Tay-Sachs? So now what? Then the shaila is it permissible to terminate such a pregnancy? A difficult, complicated, and heart-wrenching question of abortion. Or, alternatively, there's an option to do IVF with PGD. PGD stands for pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. Pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. What that means is IVF, the woman takes her, the doctor takes the eggs from the woman and combines it with the sperm of the husband, and they make those embryos in the lab. But instead of putting back the embryos into the woman, they do genetic testing on the embryos. So they have a whole line of embryos that they were able to create from this couple. They take each and every embryo and analyze the genetic makeup of each of the embryos. Embryo number one, they look at it, they analyze it, they find out that embryo number one has Tay-Sachs. So you know what they do with it? They discard it. They throw it away. Never to be used. They move on to embryo two. Embryo two also has Tay-Sachs. They discard it. They throw it away. They move on to embryo three. Ooh, this one's healthy. No Tay-Sachs. So they'll put one, this one to the side. They'll keep it. And so on and so forth. Throughout all of the embryos that this couple has created, right, they will only take and save, preserve the embryos that are healthy, the embryos that don't have any genetic defects, and all the ones that do have the genetic mutations will be discarded, never to be used again, which itself is a very common shiloh. People ask, they have leftover embryos, they've made embryos together with their husband, and now they're no longer having any more children, they've already had the children that they can handle, and they don't want any more. Are they able to discard the embryos that they have frozen in the lab? Is that permissible, or is that like discarding a Yiddish neshama? Is that allowed al pi halacha? So what is the option over here? The doctors say you should get pregnant naturally and do your amnio, and then we'll have to determine what to do with it should the fetus be a genetically abnormal one. Or you could do IVF and PGD, and from the get-go, only get pregnant with those embryos that proved to be safe and genetically intact. My son is dating a girl with Rakitansky syndrome. We get so many questions about shidduchim, so many sensitive questions about shidduchim. My son is dating a girl with Rakitansky syndrome. Rakitansky, we mentioned before, was the disease that a woman has when she's born with no uterus. So I've gotten this call before. I was the one that took the call. My son is dating a girl with Rakitansky, which means the mother knows that her future daughter-in-law will not be able to carry a child ever. Unless, the truth is, at the time when she called, they weren't doing uterine transplants. Now it's possible that they could have a uterine transplant. It's still experimental, but it's coming. It's coming. It's actually coming to the forefront, I would say, in the next 5-10 years. So without the uterine transplant, right, she has no uterus. She's never going to be able to carry her own child. Should we encourage him to marry her? Do we say that this is a shidduch that we should be encouraging our children, our friends, our siblings, our talmidim, our loved ones, whoever they may be? Is this something that we should be encouraging or not, knowing that it's going to be an extremely challenging life? It's going to be an extremely difficult and expensive life should they look into options of surrogacy. The mitzvah of puruvu is very questionable. Or do we say that no, this is a beautiful woman. She's a beautiful woman with an amazing, she'll be an amazing wife. And she, you know, fertility-wise, there's some issues, but that's not something that we should take into account when it comes to marrying her. A very sensitive issue when it comes to shidduchim. How do we help guide these couples who are, or these individuals who are seeking guidance? And then we have questions about intimacy, a very common area of questions people call with different areas, you know, different areas of intimacy. Some are just because of the stress of infertility. So based on the stress of infertility and their treatment, so it creates a lot of tension and pressure in the bedroom. So very often the doctor will tell you that if we're having a treatment, what's today? Today's Tuesday. So let's say there's a treatment on Friday morning. So the doctor says, I need you to be in my office Friday morning and I need you to deliver a fresh semen sample Friday morning. So how is this couple supposed to procure that sample? So maybe the best thing to do is that they should have relations. And after relations, they should bring the zera into the lab, let's say with a condom, or they took it out afterwards, and different options. But the whole way that they're getting the zera is through relations. So it's very timed and there's a lot of pressure and the doctor's saying, do it here. It's very prescribed. You must do it. It seems very clinical. And when they need to get the semen sample for a semen analysis, the same thing. Very often that takes a tremendous toll on one's life, on one's relationship in the bedroom. And it causes a lot of issues, even without infertility. We get calls. We do have on staff. We have sex counselors and therapists who do a lot of guidance with people who call. What's the best advice to keep the bedroom experience exciting and pleasurable throughout the busy and stressful week? A question that so many people, even irrespective of infertility, ask. We've been married for 5 years and my husband still suffers from premature ejaculation. I'm very frustrated. Please help. This is a very common question. Erectile dysfunction, premature ejaculation. These are issues that a urologist should take care of and should consider. Sometimes they are physical issues, medical issues. Sometimes it's all psychological. It really depends on the case. And after a discussion, an initial discussion, sometimes it's in the asking the right questions, it'll be apparent and sometimes obvious what the issue is, if it's a medical issue or if it's a psychological issue. Sometimes that actually is very intertwined with fertility because the premature ejaculation, the husband is motzi zera, he ejaculates before the couple is able to actually have a normal relations, a normal intimacy. But if there's no zera, so then how do they get pregnant? So very often couples like this call, number one, because they're frustrated from the intimate perspective, their intimate life is compromised because of it, but also they're unable to have children because of the premature ejaculation. So that also contributes to the stress. And halakha questions about the bedroom. I have questions about the permissibility of certain behaviors in the bedroom. Very often we get shilas, we get questions about certain behaviors. Is this mutter? Is that mutter? And, and Baruch Hashem, we're a resource for these questions, which people, as we found over the years, the reason why we are a resource is because people have questions. People have so many questions and they don't necessarily know who to turn to ask these questions. Sometimes they don't know who, in terms of the comfort, you know, sometimes it's uncomfortable to raise these questions to people who you know or who you typically ask questions to. And sometimes even the people you ask questions to don't have such expertise in these areas of halacha, which are not necessarily the most mainstream. It's not necessarily the most mainstream. So those are just a few questions, just a few of the typical normal questions that we get at Pua on a daily, on a weekly basis. And I wish I could say that I was lying to you. I wish I could say that these are the crazy questions that we get once a year, but I try not to lie. And I'm telling you all honestly that these are some of the questions that pass by our desks on a daily basis. And it's just such a schus, such a special opportunity that I, my colleagues at Pua, whether in the States or in Israel, have to be able to be the resource for so many people who have these questions, these difficult questions, and so many Rabbanim who call. Because the Rabbanim themselves have gotten the questions, and the Rabbanim want to know how to answer the questions for their constituents. You know, the more knowledgeable the Rabbanim are, so the better off their Balabatim are, their constituents are. So those are just a few of the questions. Please, if anyone has any follow-up questions or any questions on the questions, please let Mrs. Katz know. And And for the rest of for a few minutes, I want to go into just a few of the topics that I mentioned, just really just two, because they're just so common. When we talk about the common causes of infertility, so many things come up. Age is a common cause of infertility. As we know, as a woman gets older, as we said before, her fertility is compromised. PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, which we'll deal with in a little bit. Endometriosis, a condition. If you're ever schmoozing with anyone and they confide in you and they tell you that their periods are so painful that it's really incapacitating. Sometimes people have periods, women have periods that are so painful they need to take medication, and sometimes they need to take off from work. They just can't go to work. I know women that cannot work while they're getting their period. And very often that is a clear sign of endometriosis, which is not, you know, it's not normal. It's something has to be taken into consideration medically and treated. It's basically when the uterus, instead of staying put, kind of the uterine lining leaves the uterus and starts to and it starts to grow and spread outside of the uterus. And then when a woman has her period, that uterine lining, although it's not contained in her uterus, it now has left uterus, bleeds. So now the woman has bleeding from many different parts of the body, not just from the contained uterus leaving through the vaginal canal, but from all different parts of the body. Sometimes it can even go even more internal towards the lungs. I mean, it's a really, potentially it could be very, very harmful, but usually it's quite simple and getting it under control. Very often with hormonal treatment, it's not a problem, but it's just something to be aware of. Early ovulation is what I want to talk about just for a few moments. It's simple things, blocked fallopian tubes. I don't know if anyone would ever see what fallopian tubes look like in person. I don't know. I never thought that I would know what fallopian tubes look like, but they are so thin. If anyone knows what the fallopian tubes look like, they're so thin and so small. It's so common that just the smallest blockage could be the reason why a woman is not getting pregnant. And that's just a simple test that they can do with the doctor to see whether the fallopian tubes are intact. Autoimmune disorders, which are a little less common but serious. Varicoceles, which is like a varicose vein that a man can develop in the scrotum, which can kill the sperm production. Recurrent miscarriages and genetic abnormalities are all reasons, very common reasons, why a couple may be experiencing infertility. And just with a phone call, with a few questions, and maybe just, you know, looking over some medical charts, we can figure out what exactly the issue is. And when we figure out what the issue is, then we can best treat and guide each couple. It's important to note that it used to be considered a female issue. Infertility was a woman's issue. If a woman can't get pregnant, if a couple doesn't have any children, it's obviously the woman's fault. The woman, the woman, the woman. Which is so not true. If you look here in the most recent studies, it actually shows that 33% of infertility is caused by the female, but 33% is also caused by the male, which means that they're on equal playing fields. It's the exact same numbers. 33 is either because the shidduch as a couple, something's not working, or it's completely unexplained, completely unknown. But no one should think that infertility is a female issue. It is very much a both issue, which means that we should be cognizant of the fact that it's very possible that it's the male, it's very possible it's the female, it's very possible it's neither. You can't point at anyone. We don't want to point. But but those are the statistics. And I think that most people do still consider, many people consider it to be a female issue, but it's simply not true. And with the time I have, Emma, do I have a few more minutes? Okay. I can't tell you how common this question of early ovulation is. Early ovulation, when a woman goes to the mikvah after she ovulates, is such a common issue. And there are pretty simple solutions that I just want to talk to you tonight. Biologically speaking, medically speaking, it's the standard case. Let's take a woman who has a cycle of 28 days, like you'll see on my screen. A woman has a cycle of 28 days. So women typically ovulate 14 days before the onset of the next period, which means that if you have a 28-day cycle, so 14 days before 28, which brings you to day 14, is when biyutz, is when ovulation occurs. So that really is a fantastic setup Because if you go from the other direction, you look at your Nida cycle, if a woman bleeds on day one, and she bleeds for, let's say, 5, let's say even 6 days, heavy bleeding, let's say 6 days. And then she has Zayin Nikiyim, she waits 7 clean days. So that's going to bring her to either day 12 or day 13. She gets to the mikvah on day 12, day 13, still before her ovulation. Okay? So that's fine. But what happens when a woman has a shorter cycle? When she doesn't have a cycle of 28 days, but she has a cycle of, let's say, 21 days. When a woman is having a period every 21 days, every 22 days, every 23 days, take 14 days away from 21. Where do you get? What do you get? You get 7. Okay? When you get 7, that's a huge issue because 7, a woman bleeds for 5 days and then followed by another 7 days of Zayin Nikiyim. She's not going to get to her mikvah until day 12, but she only ovulated on day 7. An ovulation occurs on day 7 for only a few hours, let's say 12, 18, maybe 24 hours. But then that's it. Once ovulation is complete, so the woman will not get pregnant no matter how many times she's together with her husband. So once she goes to the mikvah on day 12, if she already ovulated on day 7, that month they will not get pregnant. Similarly, you have cases where women bleed for longer than just 5 days. So let's take a woman that has a 26-day cycle. 26 is cutting it close because, remember, take 14 days away from 26, you get to 12. 12 is still possible because if she would bleed for 5 days and then have 7 clean days, then she would be going to the mikvah on day 12, which means that she would just make it. Maybe it would be a problem, but she would just make it. However, if a woman has a 26-day cycle, which we said is already cutting it close, and then she bleeds for more than 5 days, she bleeds for 6 or 7 days, so by the time she gets to the mikvah, it's going to be day 14, 2 days after her ovulation. She's not going to make ovulation, which means that this woman, unfortunately, is not going to be able to get pregnant. So let me just give you a little basic tutorial or bring you back to high school. Bring you back to, what is it, 9th grade? That when we do biology? So you bring you back to 9th grade to a little bit of biology over here. The brain, secretes a hormone called FSH. FSH stands for a follicle-stimulating hormone. The follicle-stimulating hormone is what tells the ovaries to start producing the eggs. As we know, a woman is born with all of her eggs. Right? When a woman is born as a little baby, she has all of the eggs that she will ever have in her life. She does not produce more eggs. Males, on the other hand, produce sperm. Right? Every day, males producing more and more sperm. Women, female, do not produce eggs. They're born with their eggs. Does anyone know? It's hard for me to poll. I can't poll the audience, but I would be interested to know how many eggs people think a woman is born with. Does anyone know? I'm not sure.
Millions.
What?
Millions.
Millions. Okay, that's the truth. I neglected to do my homework before this lecture, but I think that I think this is fascinating. While they're in utero, they have millions. By the time, maybe when they're born, they're also born with about 1 million. By the time they reach puberty, they lose some of the eggs. They have lost some of their eggs. They're about to 500,000 or 400,000 eggs, which is still sufficient to have a nice sized family. But we're talking about, they started, even in utero with millions. Now, what happens is those eggs are dormant. Those eggs do not express themselves. They're in the ovaries. But every month, the ovaries starts to produce and mature one of those eggs or a few of those eggs. Only one will make it to full maturation, and that will be the egg, which is over here. You see, which is shot out of the ovary in the process called ovulation, right? So what happens is the egg gets more developed, and eventually when it's ready, it's shot into the fallopian tube. This is ovulation. When the zera comes here, the zera actually meets the egg in the fallopian tubes and fertilizes the egg over here. And then as it makes its way back into the uterus, it develops the embryo which is the combination between the egg and the sperm, develops and keeps on developing and keeps on developing. And if it gets here and it's healthy, then it implants itself into the uterine wall, and then the pregnancy begins. So the brain, that whole start, that whole process begins with the brain secreting this hormone called FSH. Now, something we have to know is when the brain creates and secretes FSH, it has to know when to stop. So how does the brain know when to stop? So the answer is when the body starts to produce estrogen, then the brain knows that we should stop creating FSH. So what a genius fertility specialist named Mike Dahan, McGill University, the great guy, a nice guy, a friend of mine. Mike Dahan had the brilliant idea. He said, I see so many women who are ovulating before mikvah. They're unable to get pregnant because they're ovulating too soon. He said, there must be a way to push off ovulation. How can I find a way to prevent women from ovulating too early? And he had a genius idea. He said, the brain is what secretes FSH. And how does it know what to stop? It knows when to stop when the brain picks up and detects the heightened levels of estrogen. So Mike Dahan, Chacham Dahan, I call him, he's a Sephardi guy, he's a Chacham Dahan. Chacham Dahan had the following idea. If we were to give women estrogen supplements in the very beginning of their cycle, before the brain even has the opportunity to secrete FSH, so then the woman who just gets her period, she takes estrogen, the heightened levels of estrogen in the body prevent the brain from secreting FSH, because the brain will never secrete FSH if it senses that there is a high level of estrogen. The only time the brain will secrete FSH is if it detects that there is no estrogen or very low levels of estrogen. Then the brain sends out the message that the ovary should start working with the FSH. But what Dahan decided was we should give women estrogen supplements to raise the levels of estrogen to trick the brain, and then, let's say for 5 days, after those 5 days are done, go off the estrogen levels will go down. When the brain detects that the estrogen levels have gone down, then the brain will send out the FSH and will start the whole process of the ovaries maturing the eggs in the ovaries maturing the eggs. But what you've done is you bought yourself about 5 days of before the whole process starts, and you've delayed ovulation by 4 or 5 days. By that time, even a woman who is unable to get to the mikvah before ovulation will probably be okay with 4 or 5 days. And that is a very common way to solve early ovulation. There's a few medical options, estrogen supplements in number two, or simple drugs like Clomid or Letrozole, which is a common medication that women take for infertility. The pool also has natural organic options. We have them from Eretz Yisrael. They are Misrad HaBriyut approved. I'm trying to work on getting them FDA approved as well. It's a little bit of a complicated parsha, but certainly they've been certified by the Misrad HaBriyut, and women have taken them in America and in Eretz Yisrael, and they've proven to be extremely successful to push off ovulation or to stop people who have longer bleed for longer. Or even an IUI, sometimes doing an IUI if a woman is unable to get to the mikvah before ovulation, sometimes inseminating. Again, the couple's not going to have any physical intimacy, but at least the zera will be able to enter the woman and be able to impregnate her. But as we mentioned in the questions before, that is a halachic issue. Sometimes they're a halachic question, I should say, not a halachic issue, just a question. In terms of the halachic options, there's so many women that are not getting to the mikvah because sometimes there are different halachic options which can help them get to the mikvah earlier. Sometimes they're waiting 5 days in order to do a hefsek tahara and then another 7 days, which means they're getting to the mikvah on day 12. But perhaps if they were to shorten their cycle by doing a hefsek tahara on day 4, like many Sfardim, but also many Rabbanim who permit a woman to do a hefsek tahara on day 4, if that's the reason why they're not getting pregnant. Sometimes women are not getting pregnant because it's taking them too long to get to the mikvah. As a bedika or two, every cycle may be questionable, and the rabbi tells them, nah, it's not such a good bedika, maybe you show it again. Maybe you should start again. Or there's so many women that don't even show bedikah cloths. There was a fascinating study done in Eretz Yisrael, in Pua in Eretz Yisrael, where they took, I forgot exactly what the number was, 50, 60, 70 women who had, or maybe it was 40 women, 43 women. I don't remember all the numbers now, but there was a number of women who all presented with this issue of ovulating before the mikvah. And what they did was they assigned each and every woman to a rav. And they said, don't move your left pinky without consulting the rav. Every step of the way, make sure you speak to the rav. And they found that the overwhelming majority of those women got pregnant naturally. And the reason why they weren't getting pregnant was because they claimed that they were ovulating before the mikvah. But really, they were making some decisions by themselves without consulting with a rav. Perhaps they just didn't have a rav to consult with. Perhaps they were uncomfortable to consult the rav. Perhaps they didn't even think it was a question. They thought that for sure they knew the answer, but they were being more machmer on themselves than the rav was. And it turned out that with the rabbinic hand-holding, they were actually able to get to the mikvah on time and get pregnant naturally. Sometimes the answer is to do fewer bedikos. Sometimes women are doing too many bedikos and they get themselves into trouble, so to speak. Sometimes the blood comes out on the bedikah cloths and holds them back, makes them restart. Sometimes it's important to see a bodekas. A bodekas tara, you know, I was told that you have in Chicago. Women who are able to check. Sometimes women assume that blood is blood and therefore we have to restart, but sometimes that blood is not uterine in nature. Sometimes it's vaginal, which would not present an issue in terms of nida. It wouldn't require you to restart, and if especially if restarting would compromise your timing, where you'd actually you'd be getting to the mikvah too late after ovulation. So it would be very important to always be in touch with Neely, right? Neely, this is, or the Kyle teachers, they'll be able to direct you on this. And sometimes wearing colored underwear or pads during Shiva Nikiyam will also ensure that you'll get to the mikvah as quickly as possible. I think that it's a little bit late, right? I think we should sum up. PCOS is just something we've discussed before. If you ever wanted to see an ultrasound, what a PCOS ovary looks like. As I said, like that traffic jam experience, really on the left, it's supposed to be just, you know, one egg, okay? But here you see the whole row of cysts, the whole row of eggs all around the ovary. So we spoke about IUI as an option, IVF as an option, all the halachic issues that come up with IVF and IUI. Does one fulfill the mitzvah peruvu? Are the children related? Is the child a kohen if the father is? Do you need supervision? How do you deal with questions of shechva zera levatala? Are you allowed to do treatment before the mikvah? Are you allowed to do these treatments on Shabbos? What happens when Shabbos coincides with your treatment? Does it render me a nida? Am I allowed to do it during nida? Bris milah v'Shabbos, am I allowed to have a bris milah if I was born through IVF? What about single women, what's available for them, egg freezing, what's not available for single women, all different issues. And if you don't believe in miracles, perhaps you've forgotten you are one. We always have to remember that the Ribono Shel Olam is able to do everything. We should always have emuna and bitachon in Hashem, but also recognize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu also sends his shluchim to the world, whoever they may be, whether it's Pua, whether it's Neely, whether it's your Rav, whether it's your Kal teacher, whoever it may be, feel free to call, to reach out to the various resources. We're all here to help. Everyone should have a good night. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Siegelman. That was really eye-opening. Just so much incredible information about the work that Pua is doing. I just have one follow-up question.
Sure.
That I got from the crowd. What would be advice that you would give to all young couples to set them up for success? Is it an issue of realistic expectations or practical advice? What would you tell a young couple, either recently engaged, recently married, when they're entering into this new phase?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I think it's a difficult question because no two people are alike. You know, people come into marriage with certain expectations. That's just the reality. My sister had five babies back to back to back to back, and my other sister had three babies back to back. You know, so when this husband is coming into marriage, they're coming in with their past experiences, what they know of, what they're exposed to, what they think is normal. And then when they come to the table, they're coming with their perception of normalcy, which may not be, as you said, the realistic perception of normalcy. I do think it's important to gently break it to them, as we said before, that even one out of seven couples suffer with infertility. And infertility looks like, you know, really looks like different, looks different to different people. And it's important, I think, you know, even to weave it into Kala classes and Chassan classes that, you know, my wife does this as a Kala teacher. She does talk about infertility and she does talk about things like miscarriage. She doesn't dwell on it. It's not really the most important, you know, appropriate place to start talking about miscarriages. But if the statistics are that, you know, 25% of pregnancies will end in a miscarriage, I don't think that a woman should be going into pregnancy thinking, oh, everything's going to be fine. There's no problem with me having a miscarriage. There's no issues whatsoever. Never going to happen to me. I would think that that's, as you said, we're setting them up for failure. That's not right. We don't have to scare people and we shouldn't see to it that they live their lives in fear, but definitely just the facts, telling them what is factual, what is common, what the statistics are, and then just know that there are resources. So I think just the knowledge of what the stats are and knowing that there are sufficient and expert resources available at every step of the game, every step of the way, anything that they should experience, there's always an organization or a person, a mentor or mentors that they could reach out to. So basically give them the, you know, let them know that the problem exists, but also provide the solution in the very beginning. Hopefully that should be comforting and it shouldn't stress them out. And if it ever comes that they'll need it, so they'll have that information in their back pocket because you gave it to them.
Okay. And sorry, just one last question, if that's okay.
I'm here all night.
Is there anything we can be doing on a communal level, either in the area of sensitivity or education, besides we're just educating our chassan and kalas? Is there anything as a community that we should be doing, that we can be doing, that PUA advocates for, that we can help in these areas?
Totally. I think as a world, in the world, I think we've come a long way, breaking the stigma. And you know, it used to be something which was shunned upon, not spoken about. Unfortunately, it is in either a number of communities or with some families, it's still something which people lack the appropriate sensitivity to. I often get questions from parents who call and they want to know what to do with their children, their grandchildren. There's no pregnancy. How come my granddaughter is not giving me a granddaughter? You know, how come my granddaughter is not giving me a great granddaughter? How come my daughter is not giving me a grand? How come? First of all, I applaud them, saying thank you so much for calling me and not calling your daughter and asking her that question, because you know she knows that she's not pregnant. You don't need to tell her that she's not pregnant. Sometimes the conversation that they call me and they have with me is after the daughter already yelled at the father for being so inappropriate and so insensitive. And, you know, he already burnt that bridge. But I think that in terms of teaching the community how to be sensitive and not saying hurtful, making hurtful comments, is a really important endeavor, raising the awareness. It's extremely difficult. We live in a society which is totally centered around children. The Yomim Tovim, Shabbos groups, Avos Abanim on Motzei Shabbos, you know, father, son, mother, daughter, learning opportunities and whatnot. There, everywhere you go, you know, there's always children in our daily lives, especially around the Yomim Tovim. The Shabbos table is centered around the kids' Dvar Torah. What did you learn from school? And especially now, everyone's been complaining about Zoom school and what am I doing with my kids? I'm home all day. My kids are home. And there are so many couples saying, do you know what I would do to have a kid on Zoom? Like, do you know what I would do to have a kid home in quarantine with them, to spend my whole day with them? And there's so many people who just don't have that. So it is extremely difficult to live a life completely sensitive and, not making any comment that's going to ever offend anyone. It's very hard, but I think we have to do everything in our power to raise awareness so that the people should know how common an issue it is and how really everyone can help. if there's a tzedakah. I know Chicago is amazing when it comes to chesed, and the Chicago tzedakah initiatives are amazing. I know personally, firsthand, the people who call with fertility help, and they say that we have money for our treatment because of chesed in Chicago. It's unbelievable. It's an unbelievable, chesed organizations that you have, and ashreichem. But people financially, if they want to give, know that these treatments are extremely expensive. And if you're dealing with couples who are young couples who are not, partners in law firms making millions, right? They're sometimes new, right out of school, starting their jobs, unable to have a baby. And now, bam, $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 in treatment is a significant amount of money, which is very stressful and very difficult. So even for the community, knowing that there are chesed opportunities to support couples who are going through these treatments, also very important. So I think there is a lot to do. The more the community talks about it, the more events there are, the more it's spoken, the more it becomes normal, I think the better the whole community will be, and the couples who are suffering as well.
Great. Thank you so much. And how does someone reach out to PUA if they want?
Sure. So, you know what I can do? I could, can I chat? Maybe I could chat everyone.
Perfect.
So I'll chat everyone my email address, esiegelman@puafertility.com. Fertility.org, as well as the number 718-336-0603 is our number. People should feel free to call, to reach out, to email me, or to call at any time of the day. If we can't pick up the phone, you leave a message, we'll call you back, or you email us, and more than happy to help in all areas, halacha, hashkafa. We're here to help the community.
Thank you so much. And just so everyone should know, I myself, along with one of our college teachers, met with Rabbi Siegelman, and the Neely hotline teachers have been informed of all of the PUA resources and are equipped to connect you to PUA if need be. So as always, you can reach out to the Neely hotline via text, email, phone call, web form on the Neely website. We're here to help you and connect you to the amazing work that PUA has been doing. Thank you again, Rabbi Siegelman, for all of your time this evening. This was really enlightening. Thank you so much.
Okay, everyone should have a wonderful evening. I hope to be in touch. Hatzlacha Rabba.
Bye, everyone. Thank you.
Bye-bye.